Was the 2016 Obama administration drug law a mistake that has actually made the nation's opioid epidemic even worse? The Ensuring Patient Access and Effective Drug Enforcement Act of 2016 was intended to expedite the delivery of pain medication to those with legitimate needs. But now critics say it has hamstrung the Drug Enforcement Agency's ability to do its job. Carl Berkowitz is the executive director of the Drug Policy Forum for Hawaii, and we're asking him to help us figure it out. Hi, Carl. Thanks for coming in.
Sure. Good morning, Chris, and thanks for having me on again.
Yeah. What was the intent of the law? Was that an accurate description of the law?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way the law was sort of marketed to the public, and even though the public wasn't paying attention, including groups like mine, really, this was one of those bills that was passed under the radar, heavy lobbying from the pharmaceutical industry, under the guise of making medicine more accessible or making sure that supplies weren't cut off to patients who actually need pain relief. Mm-hmm. But what it actually did was curtail the DEA's ability to suspend distributors from their making shipments to suspect sites, places like this town in West Virginia that's been highlighted, which has a population of some 300 people, but were getting millions of pills during a multi-year period when they clearly didn't need that.
And there's been a pretty robust industry based around distributing opioids illegally, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And there was, prior to the bill's passage, there was a crackdown on some of these distributors. Then there was the lobbying effort and basically sort of pretending to help patients, meaning that, oh, if we cut off the supply for these distributors, preventing them from making shipments, et cetera, it would hurt patients. But actually what it would hurt was the bottom line of these companies, which is why they lobbied so heavily and very successfully. So, you know, we're gratified that it seems like Congress is not going to reverse this, and hopefully the president will sign it. But, you know, I want to flag that this would be sort of a drop in the bucket type thing to sort of say, well, this terrible law was passed and we're going to repeal it and it's going to be kind of a panacea would be a mistake. It's really reflective of saying, oh, now we need more enforcement. You know, we need to crack down on the pharmaceutical companies, crack down on the doctors, crack down on the patients. If we just do it that way without addressing that pain is real, that people have needs, and look at ways to either better treat their pain or to treat their addiction, then we're going down the wrong path. So I think, you know, we got to make sure that we walk and talk at the same time and basically repeal this law while doing other things.
What has the enforcement strategy accomplished to date?
Well, it's, I mean, the enforcement strategy to date has resulted in mass incarceration, both in the federal prison system, but also at the state level. Mm-hmm. I think the estimates are that 80 to 90% of people incarcerated for drug offenses are incarcerated based on state laws, and we're no different. We have, you know, literally hundreds, if not thousands of people incarcerated in Hawaii and unfortunately in Arizona as well, based on drug offenses that are state laws. Federal prosecutors will not prioritize going after individuals usually who have possession offenses, but our city and county prosecutors are all too happy to do that in order to fill the prisons. And, you know, they do it for their reasons, but that's kind of been the main result of the enforcement approach. And it certainly hasn't helped people in need, people who are in pain.
We hear from more and more sources that the whole idea of a drug war and the notion of a war as being something that is winnable through aggressive action has failed. Are people at the state and federal level still seriously talking about a war that we can win?
I would say some people, like the current attorney general and the federal attorney general, Mr. Sessions, I think he believes in that, strangely enough. But I think let's go back to the state level. Let's go back to Hawaii. I think some of the laws that have been passed recently, decriminalizing the possession of drug paraphernalia, increasing access of naloxone, granting immunity. So naloxone is an overdose reversal drug if you take opioids. Increasing immunity for people who call 911 in case they have their own drug offenses, but they're actually trying to help someone else. Mm-hmm. So we're going towards a more public health-oriented approach in this state, and we just need to be consistent and consequential and continue to reform our state laws in that direction.
The problem with that public health approach, Carl, as you well know, is it costs money, and it costs money to take care of people who don't get a whole lot of public sympathy, drug addicts.
Correct. So, you know, what also costs a lot of money is locking up people. And basically, I think, you know, what we would advocate for, if you want to do a dollar for dollar comparison, treating someone outside of prison is a whole lot cheaper than locking them up when they are also unlikely to be treated, causing a long-term problem for society and for the individual. So it's a dollar for dollar thing, but also in terms of long-term impact, actually treating them as an investment. And for the individual and for society.
Well, in a for-profit prison system, and we seem to be moving that way nationally and locally, the more the merrier incarcerated, right?
Correct. And that's, you know, that's why we're disheartened to see the state push for a new facility here on Oahu. The contention is that we need a new facility in order to lock up some 1,100, 1,200, 1,300 people. And there's that need. And the reason is because people are currently locked up at that rate. The current facility is borderline unconstitutional, as the ACLU has contended. There's no doubt, but that doesn't justify a new facility. Instead, I think the thinking needs to be kind of shifted to how do we decrease the need for this new facility, which is expensive, and also treat people. So if we engage in practices like bail reform, law enforcement-assisted diversion, getting people away from being arrested and directly into treatment, changing some of our drug laws so people aren't locked up in the first place, if we change a bunch of different laws and policies, there'll be less of a need for this prison and people will actually be helped. So that's sort of, I think, and once people are helped, then they will no longer be these unsympathetic individuals in the eyes of the public. Instead, we're criminalizing them. So not only are they seen as unsympathetic, which I think is unfortunate when they're drug addicts, but they're also criminalized. So they're criminals too, doubly unsympathetic. And the state is contributing to that. And that is terrible. And we need to kind of move away from that paradigm.
Would it be cost effective to move in the direction you've suggested?
I would suggest, yes, there's ample evidence from numerous studies saying that, again, treatment is cost-effective as opposed to incarceration. Moreover, alternatives to detention, whether it's an ankle bracelet or diverting someone or taking them to a community outreach court or a drug court possibly, if that's the alternative for that person, all these alternatives are not only more beneficial to the individual and society, but they are cost effective as opposed to incarceration. That doesn't mean that there aren't individuals who need to be incarcerated. That's kind of a red herring that, you know, we're always confronted with. Those individuals do exist, but, you know, when you have half of the individuals at the Oahu Community Correctional Center locked up pre-trial, they haven't even been convicted and they can't post bail, I think we have a big problem there.
Carl, thanks very much for coming in. Carl Berquist is the executive director of the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii.
I'm Marco Werman. Israelis think of guns differently than Americans do.
For them, a gun is not some theoretical recreational thing. It's a burden you're forced to carry when you're 18. You're given this, you don't want it, you're responsible for it, you'll go to jail if you lose it, and then the second you're done with it, you don't want to see it again.
What America can learn from Israel about carrying guns. That plus global takes on the day's top stories. It's The World.
This afternoon at 1.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the rise of uncertified service animals. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking of an international technology and manufacturing business whose company symbol is rooted in Moanalua Gardens. The company was started in 1910 by an electrical engineer, and its first product was Japan's first 5-horsepower induction motor. The company's American group opened in 1959, and in 1975, a commercial featuring the giant monkey pod tree in Moanalua Gardens aired across Japan, beginning with the company's and country's love affair with the tree. The original commercial, today, Japanese tour buses fill the parking lot at Moanalua Gardens as people visit that more than 130-year-old tree, and some couples even get married under its canopy. The company still uses the 82-foot-tall tree with a more than 131-foot-wide canopy in commercials, but its product range has expanded from the only automotive systems to include 10 additional sectors, like family, financial services, railway systems, and IT systems. Today, we're looking for that company's name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Leilani Chan from Tiara Productions. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
We've learned much in recent years about the ways service dogs can be of value to people with a variety of disabilities, and we've seen their numbers increase. With that increase, though, has come a corresponding increase in the numbers of fake service dogs in public places, wearing ID covers purchased on the Internet, serving no apparent medical purpose. That increase is a concern for Louis Erdosik, executive director of the Hawaii Disability Rights Center, who reminded us that a true service dog is a carefully trained animal.
It does have to be specially trained to be a service dog, as opposed to where there is a lot of confusion is when you talk about, like, emotional support animals. And those are not service animals under the ADA, but they could qualify in certain conditions and under certain situations, like under the Fair Housing Act, that could be considered a reasonable accommodation to allow somebody to have an emotional support animal in their, like, in their home. So emotional support animals are a legitimate thing. I mean, what I think is happening, honestly, is that people are faking both of those kinds of things. They're faking service dogs, and they're faking the emotional support animals.
And what's the effect of that?
Well, I mean, they may get away with it, you know, I mean, on a case-by-case basis. But, I mean, to me, the real concern that I have is that the effect of it, and the reason that we've been concerned and why we oppose it and why we support some kind of law to deal with it, is that it creates a potential backlash against people with disabilities. I mean, we work hard to represent, you know, what we think are legitimate cases of people with disabilities, and these folks have enough, they experience enough stereotype and prejudice and stigmatization in their lives as it is. Mm-hmm. So when you have people that are faking these things, there's a potential that it adds to that overall sense that, oh, you guys are just, guys are just faking it. You're not really disabled. You're trying to somehow get some kind of benefit that, you know, that you shouldn't be getting. And so that's the kind of concern that we have as well, yes.
It's very easy for a fake service dog to be a public nuisance if you get into a grocery store or a hospital.
Well, in a sense that if they are not, because service dogs are supposed to be trained. They're not supposed to be barking and,
right.
you know, and misbehaving and all that. So if you bring the service dog in, or the so-called service dog in, then who knows what's going to happen, sure.
What kind of certification? Describe for me, if you will.
There is none. Okay. There is no real certification, and that's part of the issue. I mean, there was a proposal at the legislature a year or two back that talked about actually having a certification, which really wouldn't be a bad idea. The problem is that the ADA prohibits requiring any kind of a special certification for a service dog. So that because if you did have one, if you actually had a way of getting a card that's, you know, so somehow it was guaranteed that this was like a real service dog, that would sort of help solve the problem. But the ADA said the ADA would need to be amended in order to allow that. Right now, the ADA says that you cannot require any kind of special certification. So, what I think that people are seeing, and I've seen these ads, is there's these places that have ads for these like phony service dog kits, right? You send them some money, and then they send you a thing that says service dog, and you can kind of slap a vest or a collar on your dog and take it with you, and it says service dogs. These things are totally fake. I mean, they're not based on any kind of real thing, and because there is no such thing as a certification, the whole thing is kind of a fraud. But places are selling that to people, and people are doing that, and so you could put that on any dog and make it look like a service dog.
Well, Lewis, yeah, that you really surprised me with that, because I suspect a lot of other people assume that when they do see, and we're talking about legit service dogs now,
right,
that they have gone through, you know, a fairly strict process, like a seeing eye dog.
Well, yeah, the seeing eye dog is the easiest example, obviously.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think anybody has ever complained about somebody who's blind who's using a seeing eye dog.
You can't fake.
They don't generally run into issues. But in truth, I mean, the thing is that not so much seeing eye dogs, service dogs can be a wonderful thing. I mean, we've actually really come a long way in terms of the kinds of things that they do for people. I've seen cases of like children that are on the autism spectrum where the dogs actually help to make sure that they don't run off, you know, because they're not focused. There are people with mobility balance issues, and there are service dogs that are trained to keep them balanced. There are dogs that are trained to sense if somebody is about to have a seizure,
right,
and it can warn them. If somebody has even somebody has PTSD, the dog can kind of like go into the room first and check it out and make sure everything's okay. So the potential use of service dogs has actually increased a lot beyond just seeing eye dogs. And in all those cases that I was just talking about, those are legit, real service dogs. There's no question about it. They are specially trained.
Does a seeing eye dog go through a certification process?
It goes through a training process. When I say certification, I mean certification that this is like an official service dog. They have the seeing eye dog is specially trained. They're all a service animal by definition. It goes through a special training process.
Right, but what you're saying is, without a formal certification process, there's no way to know.
There's no way to really. It's much more difficult to tell if it's a real service because a person who let's say you're a storekeeper, right, and somebody's coming in and you want to know, the ADA prevents them from asking a whole lot of questions. The only two questions really that they can ask, they can say, is this dog a service animal because of a disability, yes or no? And then a second question will be, what work or task has the dog been trained to perform? They cannot say, so what's your disability? They're not allowed to ask that kind of that kind of a question. But they can ask what work has the dog been trained to perform?
And they'd probably be disinclined to ask anything given the delicacy of doing that.
Well, sometimes people are afraid they're going to get sued or something if they do that. So there are some concerns about not wanting to overstep. I understand.
Yeah.
But, I mean, honestly, the stores do have the right. Restaurants have the right. I mean, people can bring a service dog into a restaurant, but they can't, like, feed it from the table. It's supposed to go under the table. So if it's a real service dog, I mean, I've been out after conferences, let's say with some, I remember being out with there was one woman that was blind, and we all went out to a restaurant, and she had no problem getting accommodated. I mean, because the seeing eye dog is the easy example, but some of these other service dogs are maybe real service dogs, but it's not as obvious.
Well, as someone who works with disability rights, what would you like to see being done with the whole issue of the fake service dog?
I think there should be some accountability and some penalties. I think there ought to be a way to crack down on these places that send out these advertisements, whether it's via the internet or the mail. I've got booklets like that. I think they ought not to be permitted to advertise that kind of a product.
Louis Erdacek is the executive director of the Hawaii Disability Rights Center.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
The American way of dying is a $20 billion industry in this country, one that has never worried too much about its impact on the environment. According to one estimate, the funeral industry buries enough metal every year to build another Golden Gate Bridge. But there's a new trend in the industry, biodegradable coffins. Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton has the story of a Waimanalo company that's adapting to that trend in today's reality check. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
All right. This story got me thinking about how whatever the opposite of green is, how non-green the funeral industry really is.
Well, yes. There's been a fair amount written about this recently. A fairly new book called Grave Matters goes into this into some depth. But yes, generally people are starting to really take a look at this and think about this, as you said, you know, massive amounts of metal being buried in the ground every year, and formaldehyde-based embalming fluids, that sort of thing. So, you know, even the industry is really looking at this and saying we should offer people other options.
Well, what are the other options, Stuart?
Well, again, there are a number of things. There's a trend to not requiring embalming. Again, most states do not require that by law, so that is something that already is out there, and more people are getting educated about it. The same with more environmentally friendly embalming fluids. There are things like cremation urns made out of Himalayan salt that sort of dissolve in the ocean or underground easily if they were buried. A number of options are caskets made of wicker and seagrass. And again, in the case of the company that we talked to this week, they're making caskets out of reclaimed wood. This is wood that really would be thrown away, buried in the landfill, or chipped for mulch or something. But instead, they're making coffins out of it.
One of the things about the traditional funeral industry that takes a lot of families by surprise is the sheer cost.
Yes. We spoke to the National Funeral Directors Association, and the cost of a funeral, the median cost in by the most recent numbers, was about $7,000. And more than half of that goes for things that are generally not really considered green. That's an expensive, maybe a metal coffin, embalming, and a vault. This is, most cemeteries require a sort of concrete vault that the casket goes into. So, yes, it can be very expensive. A green funeral with a degradable casket in a field, a sort of natural green cemetery that doesn't have vaults, might have unmarked graves. It'll give you a general location where your loved one is buried. Could be much, much less expensive.
Is that a coming trend? Is that being adapted by a new generation? Adopted by a new generation?
It seems like it is. Again, the Courtney Gusick, who is the founder of the company that we profiled, that's what they did with her father in Oregon when he died. And it really does seem to be something. I don't know that it's happening here yet, but she certainly wants to do that here, and it seems like it's only a matter of time.
It does seem, you know, that so many other industries have really revised the materials they use. It does seem as if this industry is a late bloomer in a sense, yeah?
It does. And again, that's really why we wrote about this. Again, it's such a new company. We really usually wouldn't write about something that's so new, but it is a new company that's on part of a trend that really seems to be here to stay.
Well, we'll just have to see. Thanks, Stuart.
Thank you, Chris.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Stuart Yurton.
Looking for something uplifting? Look no further than the Atherton Studio, where on Saturday, December 2nd, HPR presents Big Island harpist Momi Riley. Her poetic lyrics, angelic voice, and the music of her harp will raise your spirits. Purchase your seat at hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Home ownership in Hawaii remains a good investment for those who can afford it. But as prices continue to creep higher, the dream gets farther away for low to moderate income residents. Sue Ann Lee is the president of the Honolulu Board of Realtors, and as we reviewed the board's latest figures on Oahu home sales, she cited a principal concern for local home buyers, a proposed change to federal tax law.
Right now, the House has propose that the mortgage interest deduction be limited to $500,000 on your primary residence. And that affects a lot of people in Hawaii because most of our homes are, you know, the median sales price is $735 mm-hmm. for a single family house. And so they're not able to use the difference if they have a loan on the property. Mm-hmm. And the Senate is looking to keep it at $1 million, which is what we are preferring over the House version.
What difference is that? What's the effect on a home buyer, homeowner?
I've read somewhere where it may affect at least 30% of buyers, especially in our market.
Driving their prices up, driving their costs up?
Yes, and they're not, yes, affordability, mm-hmm. you know, because they won't be able to deduct the taxes or the interest on their taxes.
Are you lobbying against that, or realtors?
Yes, yes. We've done some calls for action to all our membership, and we've also forwarded it on to some of our clients so that they're aware of what's happening. And I think we've seen a lot of press locally regarding that.
So we don't know yet where that's going to end up.
No,
right?
We don't.
But that would have a negative impact on Hawaii.
Very much.
How would you characterize Hawaii's real estate market? Stable, volatile, somewhere in between?
I think it's pretty stable. Over time, we've seen steady increases on median sales prices. Mm-hmm. But we just don't have enough inventory, and that's our issue with the market.
We don't have enough inventory, therefore prices
continue to rise.
Continue to go up. What can change that? What will change that?
I think it's a concerted effort between the state, the city, and developers in working together toward seeing more building.
Is that concerted effort underway?
We're trying. They realize, the government realizes there is a problem. And the developers really would like to build, but there are their costs to build, and they're building into the future. So if you have great interest rates now, and anything changes, the cost of building construction changes, and then you'll see that it may not be feasible.
Does that lead to hesitation on the part of developers? Is that the reason they might hesitate to embark on a large-scale project?
Yes. In fact, Kaka'ako was built successfully because there was no infrastructure charges.
It was already there.
Yeah.
That's not true of other areas where people
Correct.
Might be building, right?
Right.
Well, whose responsibility is it to create the infrastructure? Does that get into a governmental area?
Yes, I would think it would be the government.
Mm-hmm.
We look at corridors such as Mo'ilili, Mekelle area, where there are a lot of low-rise apartment buildings. And you could see, well, we should have condominiums there. And we have a few just here and there. But the infrastructure is not there. The sewage capacity cannot handle it.
Is that true of a great many Honolulu neighborhoods, for example?
I would think so, because you see, there was a time when there were a lot of ohanas, and now, as well as ADUs, the sewage.
What's an ADU?
Accessory dwelling unit, whereby you might be able to build another building project onto your property and use it for family.
Mm-hmm. An ohana dwelling.
Yeah, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. So absent that, I mean, that now you're talking about a kind of a social shift, aren't you?
Yes. You see, ADUs and ohanas are really for families.
Right.
But, we have a lot of homeless, and that is our problem right now. How do you build enough for our homeless people who choose to want to get into a place to rent or to buy? And it has to do with costs. And when you talk about renters, the cost of renting keeps going up, because the people who are buying, if they're buying for an investment property, as an investment property, they're going to try to get at least, they want to cover their costs.
They want the price to go up.
Well, not necessarily. Sometimes they want to reserve something for their family in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So, when the kids go to the mainland, they go to school, they want to come back. But there's a place for them to come back to.
Well, when you talk about the difficulties of providing housing for the homeless, I mean, when I see the new construction that's going up near where we are now in Kaka'ako, that isn't going to house the homeless. That's not even going to house the middle class. Those are high-rent, high-priced dwellings, right?
But if you would check with the developers, you'll find that a lot of the units are being sold to Hawaii residents.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit difficult to tell because we go by tax address,
mm-hmm.
okay? But 80% or so are sold to local people. And then it becomes a step ladder, okay? So they will sell their house where they're currently living in to move to this new residence.
Mm-hmm.
And whoever buys their house is coming from someplace. So it's a stepladder effect.
So that's putting more people in homes.
Yeah.
But it's still, those new homes being bought are well north of $500,000, right?
Right.
That's a lot of money. I mean, that's you've got to be pretty well comfortably in the middle class to even think about something like that, don't you?
Well, the median sales price for condos has gone up to in the 400s right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it's difficult.
What's the strongest growth area you see in, for instance, on Oahu?
I would say it would be the Ewa Beach area. you know, Eva Beach, Makakilo.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we see a lot of new homes being built. However, and they're very affordable. But, you know, you see that this causes a problem as far as transportation, coming back into town,
yeah,
and staying staying on the freeway for an hour or so.
Mm-hmm. That adds a lot to the
quality of life.
The quality of life, yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So, as an investment, real estate remains a pretty good investment overall.
Yes, over time it does remain a good investment. I would say if you're willing to hold for 3 to 5 years,
you're going to make money.
You're fine. Yeah, you'll make money, or you'll have something for your children to come back to.
And yet, in 3 or 5 years, we don't know what social changes, economic changes. There's so many things that can't be predicted over a period of time like that, right?
That's correct.
So, what do you do about that?
We ask for help from the government. I think, you know, just we need more housing, and it's working together with city, state, people from our profession as realtors, builders. And what we're trying to do with the board is actually get these people together and have a discussion. What can we do to help?
When you say to legislators we need more housing, what is it that they can do to make that possible?
It's permitting. Allowing permitting, building on having infrastructure put into place, allowing it. It's budget. I mean, you know, the money comes from somewhere. So we have to realize as residents of Hawaii that the money comes from somewhere, and perhaps we all have to pay a little bit more. And that might be in property taxes. It could be sales tax, whatever it happens to be.
This still would seem to eliminate a great many people, that system. When you say we have to pay a little bit more, a lot of people are going to be saying, I don't have any more, right?
Correct.
Doesn't that marginalize a greater number of people as prices go up?
Probably so.
Sue Ann Lee is the president of the Honolulu Board of Realtors.
Aloha, I'm Tim Delaney, president of the National Council of Nonprofits, and you're listening to The Conversation, a member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
This company is known for the durability of its manufactured products and its technology, and has been described as having the most reliable hard drives on the market back in 2014. Its wide variety of products also includes air conditioners, circuit boards, ATMs, and wind power generation systems. The company has advertised its accomplishments and its values in commercials that air in Japan, featuring a historic monkey pod tree in Mauna Loa Gardens. The tree is registered as an exceptional tree by the City and County of Honolulu and cannot be removed or destroyed without City Council approval. Its iconic umbrella shape is the main feature of this Japanese company's commercials. In December of 2006, the company agreed to pay a new owner of Mauna Loa Gardens $400,000 a year for the right to use the tree in advertising. Previously, the company only paid $20,000 a year for these rights. While the bill is hefty, a Japanese marketing advisor said the contract was easy to understand because Hitachi, the technology and manufacturing giant, has immediate brand recognition when the image of the monkey pod tree appears. And Greg Ha of Kailua knew that, so he's today's winner of our backyard quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. 100 years after her death, Hawaii's last queen, Liliuokalani, continues to exert a powerful influence on the people of her islands. Hers is a legacy of cultural pride, a love of music and art, and a reverence for the value of education. Filmmaker Edgy Lee is marking the centennial with a film, Reflections of Our Queen, that explores that legacy through her written reflections and the memories she left behind with friends and family. The film is about to have its debut on local television, and Edgy's with us in our studio. Thanks for coming in, Edgy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
What was she like?
Ooh, good question. She was multifaceted.
Yeah.
I mean, faceted, sorry. Quite complex, very intelligent, innovative thinker, and bold and courageous.
At a time in the late 19th century when women weren't particularly encouraged to be that way, right?
No, not at all. And when you realize the Victorian era really gave women very few rights,
yeah.
You know, married women especially, you begin to understand how difficult it was for her during those few tumultuous years. But even after the overthrow, what she continues to endure, I can't even begin. I mean, 2 hours is not enough for film on
yeah.
her. I mean, I know it's a long time, but, you know, we have a 78-minute film, and that was not, I mean, we had to pick and choose so carefully what we could include. There was so much to say about her.
What do you think are the things that are going to emerge from a viewing, a single viewing? You know how, as a filmmaker, you know that there's only a certain amount of people are going to retain. What would
yeah.
you hope that they would retain?
You know what I do hope, Chris, that they tune in the following Sunday on December 10th. No, seriously, because there is so much that I didn't know that is contained in the film.
Yeah.
And a lot of subtleties. And people will miss a lot, I think. And it's a really great thing, I think, to watch again. Those scholars or perhaps people who are expecting a film on the overthrow, this is not that film.
Yeah.
This film is full of oral histories that are remembrances that were inherited by families. And I truly believe that the stories they tell are verbatim from how they heard them from their grandparents, who heard them from their parents. And we were lucky to collect some incredible stories of people who would be over 100 years old today. There are a few interviews in this film that were given to us by Professor Larry Kimura, UH Hilo,
uh-huh.
and Dr. Pila Wilson, his partner, who made a film in 1986 on Her Majesty the Queen. And a couple of those interviews, I mean, all of their interviews are great. We just had a chance to just handpick a few. They are so incredibly rare. There's one woman, Fanny Burns, who tells a story of when she was a little girl, they gave her a letter that came from England to deliver to the Queen when the Queen was incarcerated in that little room upstairs where we shot.
Right.
And she goes across the street, and they don't think anything of it. They think, oh, a little girl, oh, she'll visit her Queen. She's up there, and she delivers this letter. And in recollection, she's now in her 90s when she gave them this interview in 1986 or so.
Uh-huh.
She says, they didn't even pay attention to me. And I didn't understand, why did the Queen cry when I left? She says, not until later did I realize that she was imprisoned.
That's the kind of... That's the kind of story that gives you goosebumps when you're embarked on a project like this, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is such a stress to want to be true to the Queen, her story, to tell it in her own words, and that's exactly what we did. We took her writings, diary entries, and letters that she had written, personal letters, and used those letters. And Marlene Tsai does an incredibly beautiful job voicing the Queen. And there is one scene where Marlene is on camera. She's walking to the room where they put her, and it's all the Queen's writings. I think that will be surprising to people to hear the elegance in her wordsmithing and her ability to express herself was just phenomenal, very talented.
So often in documentary, you, as you well know, you embark on a documentary with certain goals, and then all the way along, you're surprised. Right,
shocked.
you don't. Your end product can never be what you thought it was going to be when you started out, because then it wouldn't be a documentary.
Yes, like the fact that Washington Place was being renovated just about the time that we wanted to go and shoot, but we were able, through the grace of Mrs. Ige and the Dechanalo and the people at Washington Place, to make an exception and allow us to film a little in there. And Robert Casimiro is our narrator. He does a great job. His timing is impeccable.
The whole idea of doing a biography of anyone is that you want to avoid, you know, making them so hagiography, make them so wonderful that nobody's that wonderful, right? And yet you don't want to do completely warts and all, but in order to be real about someone, how do you meet that challenge, you know?
You give that character, that real person who's no longer there to defend or argue or say, no, I don't want that. You make sure that you portray a well-balanced portrayal of that person. And so some of her personal letters, where she's writing letters to her soon-to-be husband, are really touching. They're very real. We see her, I would hope that the audience will agree, we see her in a light where she's seen as not only the last reigning monarch, but a woman during a very interesting time for women.
Yeah.
An artist, an author. So she is the first, I believe, Native Hawaiian and perhaps Native American author that was nationally published. She's also the first music copyright holder in Hawaii. She's also the person who funded over 150 scholarships for young girls who the thought of them going to college or even high school, actually, was rare. And she did all of this. And all of this was done during a time where she was really, I think, misinterpreted and misquoted and insulted in many ways. And though you see this, the growth of a woman in this position and at the end of her life, her message to everyone is compassion. Forgive them.
Where do you think she got these qualities?
She was born with them. She comes from a long line of very talented, expressive people. I mean, everyone in her family was a songwriter, a chanter. Do you know that King Kalakaua first wrote the Kumulipo in Hawaiian? He documented it and wrote it. That's like thousands and thousands of stanzas.
Yeah, sure.
She took that and wrote it in English, interpreted it, translated it into English. Without it, we would never know what that was. I mean, there were very, very many accomplishments that we don't know about. And I do hope that in the greater landscape of American heritage, and there are those listeners who would argue, you know, not American, absolutely Hawaiian, yes. But we're now part of America.
Mm-hmm.
But she's unheralded as a woman of incredible accomplishments. And I would hope that they would include our Queen Liliuokalani when they talk about history in these states.
History, we can never stop revising history, can we?
That's true.
I mean, it's a mistake anyway to think that even with, you know, people who have been well documented and numerous biographies written, there's always something more to find.
You know, I'm sure there will be historians and scholars who will see the film and say, well, why didn't they do this? What? We couldn't do everything, but we certainly tried to give the audience a general overview of her as a person.
That'll be, I think, enormously valuable, Edgy.
I hope so.
Must have been a fascinating project.
It changed me. It did.
Exhausting, too, I bet.
Yes.
Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
Edgy Lee is the director of Reflections of Our Queen, which will air local on television on KHNL at 7:30 p.m. on November 26th and December 10th.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, why doesn't everyone get the flu vaccine? There are lots of reasons, including this one.
When a vaccine is working, nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody's going to go out there and write a newspaper article about a vaccine. Oh, it's working, you know?
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7, following Counterspin.
A lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and our Morning Edition host, Derek Palama, joins us to look at events going on in our community a little under the radar. And we've got something going on in the Big Island tomorrow, Derek.
Yes, you can learn about Japanese Americans who were detained on the Big Island during World War II. And while many people know about the Honouliuli internment camp on Oahu, which is now a national monument, they may not know that Japanese Americans were also detained at the Kilauea military camp on the Big Island.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And National Park Service archaeologists and rangers will give tours of this former detention camp, and you can talk story with the granddaughter of a detainee. This is from 9 a.m. until noon tomorrow at Kilauea Military Camp in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, and it's free.
And the poetry slam movement is growing all the time, isn't it, Derek?
Yes, and you can take part in a teen slam poetry workshop tomorrow in Honolulu. Youth Speaks Hawaii promotes teen literacy and civic engagement through the performance art of slam poetry. And this teen slam poetry event is tomorrow from 4:30 to 6 in the Arts at Mark's Garage on Nu'uanu Avenue, and that's free.
And here's a chance to make your own Hawaiian featherwork. Now, that looks difficult.
Yeah, well, go there. People should go there and try it themselves. I've never done it, so I should try one day.
You should.
Kahili are a form of that traditionally acknowledged person's status and genealogy, and it offered spiritual protection. And they're also beautiful examples of art. People can make a small kahili pa'alima, that is a handheld kahili, tomorrow on the Kilauea Visitor Center Lanai from 10 a.m. until noon. It's free, but park entrance fees apply for this.
I guess you got to bring your own feathers, too.
Oh, they'll find out.
We'll find out.
Yes.
Thanks, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. And you can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And that's it for today. Up tomorrow, contributing editor Neil Milner shares his long view on the decline of local news coverage and the consequences. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Or you can post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.